And after me, there'll be others. You're going to kill them too? You're mad! You're a bloody madman!
You are a young man, dressed as a clown, about to be murdered. Put the mask on, Myra.
No. No.
Put it on.
No, please.
Put it on. Finally, at your moment of dying, you are yourself. A sniveling dago clown. Farewell. Punchinello.
This is the emergency podcast system. This is not a test. Movies are bombing all over the country. They are posing as movies you already know. They may already be in your theaters, your neighbor's home, or even your own. Do not panic. Specialists have been dispatched. They will help you identify these pretenders and defend you against this invasion of the remake. Please stand by for further instructions.
Welcome to the Invasion of the Remake podcast. I am your host, Jason Bishop. And before I introduce our intrepid co-hosts, I do want to, for one of the rare times, I actually give you a spoiler warning. Because we're going to be talking about Sleuth. And it's a mystery. So unless you want to know what the mystery is without watching the movie, I would say go watch the movies and then come back. And join us in the conversation. We'll wait. Okay. I assume you've watched the movies now. You're back. And with me today, as always, is Sam Stepanenko.
You're sleeping with my wife again, aren't you, Jay?
You're not supposed to know about that. This got awkward real fast.
You know, not much gets by me. Wait a minute. Everything gets by me. Hang on a second here.
Well, she was interested because I told her I was a hairdresser, but she knows I'm not a hairdresser. I don't know why. That's why she has, I put the bowl over her head. I hope you like the new cut, by the way.
Oh, it's cute.
Oh, good. I have a skill I didn't know I've had. I mean, I did not sleep with your wife.
I hope not.
out of this whole thing, I'm more concerned about the fact that Jay used a bowl, and I just felt more his speed would be the Flowbee. That's what concerns me.
You're assuming I know what that is, Trish Coughlin.
You do. The late night ads, the Flowbee, you put it to your vacuum cleaner and it cuts your kid's hair.
I actually don't know what that is. Now, like, and this is the world I live in now because I cut the cable a long time ago, which means unless I'm sitting on Tubi or the Roku channel, I don't see commercials at all.
Oh, no, but I mean, this is from the 90s. You should have.
I have wiped out all that stuff. If I was up that late, I was probably watching Doctor Who on PBS.
Or porn.
Yeah.
In the 90s, probably not. Probably not. That would have been right around the time I was either living at home with my parents and my brother or living with Sam and my roommates. None of which where I can really get away with porn. So, but today, yeah, we're going to be talking about Sleuth from 1972 and Sleuth from 2007. This is Trish's birthday pick. And Trish, why don't you tell us why you picked these?
We hadn't done kind of like a mystery in a while. And this is one that the original Sleuth was like kind of really well regarded. And finding out that they remade it, I was kind of, that's kind of dumb. And I was just kind of itching for a bit of Michael Caine. So it was a perfect storm of those things.
Well, it definitely works. When I watched this movie, the first thing that came to mind is, thank God I'm not remaking this.
Yes.
This would have been sitting on the shelf with really difficult.
Yep.
Yeah. No, in watching it, I'm like, I can't believe they actually remade it because it was so, so well done.
Yes.
Yeah. And this is kind of falls in that category of maybe it's not quite a remake because the screenwriter, who's a very good screenwriter of the remake, Harold Pinter, he'd never seen the original film and he'd never seen the play. He only had the script for the stage play, the original Anthony Schaffer stage play. And he made his adaption from that, which is why they're so different and yet still hit the same notes. There's like not one repeated piece of dialogue from either one of these movies. And let me tell you, there's a lot of it.
Oh, yeah. This is a cast of two in both movies. Yep.
Oh, you spoiled one of the mysteries right away.
Yeah, right. You warned them.
Exactly. There's one thing I wanted to bring up, too, which is kind of funny. The original 1972, based on a play, feels like a movie. And the remake, because of how small the set is, feels a lot more like a play. In a strange way.
I don't know if that was done with intent, but I think because it's small, it's meant to instill claustrophobia into the viewer because it's such a tight, barren space. It's almost a complete opposite of what it is in the original film, which is big mansion, wide open and cluttered with lots of fun stuff.
Yeah.
And which leads me to a question. Which mansion would you live in?
Oh, fun stuff. Old wood, big mansion, fun stuff.
Mm-hmm. Me too.
I would too, especially considering the way Branagh sort of chose to shoot it with all that blue light. It just felt really cold.
Cold, sterile. It was like looking into a show home in a vault.
Yeah, he did a really good job of using that to make you feel uncomfortable in the situation, but it didn't make me want to live in that house.
Yeah, and you know what? I didn't buy that he said, oh, my wife did the decorating. No woman in her right mind would do that.
Yeah, nobody's like doing sliding doors and a wall with all your books and projectors on the walls. And it felt like
it's
a
the
fucking
walls.
Disco at times.
Yeah.
It's like, this is so, it's
it
actually
like a prison to me.
Yeah. There's I always complained about my brother's place. His wife kind of keeps it looking like a show home. It's not built for comfort at all. And now that I've seen this movie, I'm like, oh, that is way more comfortable in my brother's house. Because, like, you're sitting on concrete and stuff. This guy's living in a prison. It feels like of his own making.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's kind of what we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. But I think that's what Milo was talking about. The third act is sort of how he's created his own prison. But we'll get there. I don't want to get too far ahead of ourselves. I will say right now that I liked both movies. I loved the first one, and I liked what they did with the second one. It's not as strong, but I still liked it.
I liked where they were going. I didn't quite buy where they ended up. I wanted something a bit more.
Yeah.
That's the way I felt too, yeah.
Yeah, I felt the same way. Like, it felt like the Branagh version was in a bit of a hurry, where the other one took its time. I mean, maybe there's too much time in the original, and then then with the amount that they cut, it's almost too short. Like, the original's 138 minutes. That is, well over 2 hours. And the remake is 88 minutes, just under an hour and a half.
Yeah.
Right?
They cut a whole, almost like 50 minutes out of it almost. Which, it felt like they did leave some stuff out that would have made it a little more interesting, especially that third act.
And you know what? It felt the same length to me, both of them. Because the other one kind of like hops along and I'm happy to go on the adventure. And the second one, it's sort of like just coming at you. And I'm like going, oh, I liked how in the original there were those humorous moments.
Yes. I was just about to say that, the moments of levity to kind of break up the tension.
Mm-hmm. Almost like they're just enjoying the verbal barbs back and forth and the play of it all. There's no enjoyment in the second one, maybe individually speaking, but it's a lot darker in tone. And like Trish, I felt it kind of, I lost the ride in the third act. It just, I don't like it where it ended up. It was a little more uncomfortable, which maybe was the point, but I kind of enjoyed it, the original one, more, just because, I mean, you're dealing with two incredible actors in that film. I mean, both. Yes. It's one of the rare times where the entire cast has been nominated for Oscars, which is fairly simple when there's only two. But but the interesting thing about the original film is there are more credits, and they're all fake. Like when I went to check them, they only have that one credit. And then when you watch the film, because I do my research ahead of time, and when you watch the film and you're like, oh, I get it. it was misdirection. Which is fun, but in 1972, you don't have the advanced look at IMDb and stuff. I feel like that gimmick works better now, but they didn't do it in the remake. Yeah. So
you need to be turned into a sleuth to find out all the wrong red herrings of characters.
Yeah, and I'm wondering if union rules or whatever forbid them from doing fake credits at that point in time. But I feel like the fake credits should have been there in the second one, even more so than the first one, as your misdirect.
Yeah, because you keep waiting for these other characters to show up and they never do.
Yeah, exactly. Well, they kind of do. At least the inspector does. But others are just off screen and they still get credits. And they're never voiced.
No, they're just referenced.
Yeah, they literally are credits on a screen of people who don't exist. Which I thought was wonderful. But it was a gimmick I think was a little wasted, because in 72, you had to have been paying attention. And now, where people like us are doing research ahead of time, or you're looking things up, who's in this movie, while you're sitting in the theater, and boom, you got your two actors, and now you know there's only two actors in the film, which was a brave choice. I thought they might change that in the remake, but they stuck with that feel.
Well, I think it's important because the movie is about that dynamic that they create from their initial meeting to getting to know each other, and this really weird, almost mutual respect that they have, but they still intensely dislike each other at the same time. It's actually really interesting. And I think it was conveyed really well in both movies. But I think the thing that made a big difference to me in the first one is all the way through the original, you find Michael Caine very likable and you're rooting for him. Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that Jude Law's portrayal of Milo went from likable, well, moderately likable, because I found him kind of a bit of a pompous ass right from the beginning, to really unlikable. So the ending didn't have the impact that it could have if he'd have been likable.
Oh, yeah. And it would have also been in the original when they had both of them sort of sparring, just verbally sparring witticisms. It sort of, in the original, it felt like they were kind of charming each other. And having them try to charm each other in the remake would have probably played in a lot better into that final act idea that they were working towards.
Yeah, when you watch in the original, you can see where Pinter had come up with that extrapolation of how the character's relationship changes in that remake. And we'll get there. I'm kind of dancing around it a little bit right now.
Right.
But I can see where that extrapolation had come from. And it makes sense. Overall, I don't think they needed to go there and put a finer point on it, but it was an interesting place to go where, you know, you have basically two man children trying to one up each other in the original. You know what? Both actually are extreme commentaries on class, especially in England, where class and status are far more a thing. I mean, I think that's getting more into North America, as well as the extreme rich get more extremely rich and the poor class get even poorer. But in England, you've got lords and sirs and all sorts of stuff. Mm-hmm. So there is a certain amount of status that they're making commentary of. By the way, if you want to be a lord, just go buy like a square foot of Scotland. And then you can shove it up their asses. And you can be a lord too. I'm thinking about buying my parents that so they could be a lord lady. Yeah.
Nice. There's also some elements of racism in there in both films. It's quite extreme in the original, but it's also hinted at in the remake as well, with the fact that Milo is half Italian. So, yeah, there's a lot of commentary in there in between this really brilliant dialogue and this really claustrophobic setting. Like, even in the original, even that's a big house, it still feels a little claustrophobic, but not to the extent that the remake does, though.
Well, the claustrophobia in the original sort of comes from, well, can we get there with the second act with the inspector showing up? It's the constant questions and the constant asking what's going on. Like that mm-hmm. kind of adds to a claustrophobic element.
Yeah. And as the inspector closes in on him and making the frame tighter and tighter and tighter on them as well, which instills that claustrophobia. I mean, part of it too is these big rooms are filled with stuff. And they're constantly showing the stuff. I think it might be one of the earliest things where I'm like going, I bet you there's a lot of Easter eggs in here that I just don't get the reference to, especially that little award sitting all by itself on the shelf. And they kept cutting towards it. That was actually belonged to the original playwright and screenwriter of the original film.
Nice.
Yeah. So that was his award. I
was expecting something to happen with that.
Yeah, I thought so too. I thought it would have been maybe disguised as a murder weapon, or there was some evidence behind it. They kept cutting towards objects and things that, like, is the body inside the mannequin? Like, I kept thinking, and right? They did such a good job of like cutting towards it all the time that makes you think that, oh, that's going to play into something, and it never does, but it gets your mind reeling that maybe it is. And I got to say, this is one of the first mysteries that I did not have figured out. Like midway through the film, I'm like going, we still got like over an hour to go and one of our cast members is dead.
Right?
you figure out pretty quickly, in my eye, I recognize that voice.
Yeah.
The makeup wasn't as good, but it was 1972. So
I thought the 70s makeup.
Michael Caine.
Yeah. No, I thought the 70s makeup was actually better. Believe it or not, I didn't think it was good, as good at hiding. Well, neither were as good at hiding their voice. I recognized the voices right away, but I found that Jude Law was fairly recognizable even under his makeup.
Well, what's really interesting is when you talk about class in the UK is how they somewhat also, they know the voices will be recognized. So the other way to conceal them is by using maybe some regional accent that's considered lower class.
And that's exactly what Caine did in the original. Was, I mean, he definitely used an accent very different from his own usual accent.
And that would sort of give the hint that's like, oh no, this is a lower class copper. So the rich guy wouldn't even notice.
In case you haven't clued in yet, Inspector Doppler was Michael Caine. Mm-hmm. Spoiler. And with that, here's some more spoilers by running the trailer for the original Sleuth from 1972.
Think of the perfect crime. The house is empty. Have you ever actually committed a crime before? Then go one step further. This, as they say, is where the plot thickens.
It's a real game and a real murder. There's absolutely no point in playing another pretend game. Isn't that right?
Palomar Pictures International presents.
I understand you want to marry my wife.
With your permission, of course.
Laurence Olivier.
You may not agree with this, Inspector, but you take it from me. The shortest way to a man's heart is through humiliation. You soon find out what he's made of.
Michael Caine.
Why don't I just keep tapping you lightly on the head with a poker until the lump comes up?
Can't make a game out of real murder.
We'll see.
In Joseph L. Mankiewicz's film...
You're mad! You're a bloody madman!
You are a young man, dressed as a clown, about to be murdered.
Of Anthony Schaffer's Tony Award-winning play, Sleuth.
You actually put a gun to his head and pulled the trigger? As a game?
You know the answer to that just as well as I do.
We have your note summoning Mr. Tindall here. Shots were heard, bullet holes made, blood is on the banisters and the carpet. His clothes were hidden in your wardrobe and he has disappeared. Who needs a body?
I'm sorry you appear to find this all quite so funny.
I did not murder him!
It's the truth.
Liar.
That was Sleuth from 1972. Screenplay and the original stage play was by Anthony Schaffer, who we have actually talked about before because he wrote the screenplay for episode 181 when we talked about
Murder on the Orient Express.
Okay. And then again in 188,
The Original Wicker Man, the good one.
That's right. And this was directed by Joseph L. Mankiewicz. And boy, he's got some big ones under his belt. Guys and Dolls from 1955, The Quiet American from 1958, and Cleopatra from 1963. Some big pedigree here.
Yeah.
Well, what's funny is The Quiet American was remade with Michael Caine.
Oh, there's a lot more Michael Caine to come up.
Yeah. This was also Mankiewicz's last film. His last one he directed, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, his last feature, yeah. And I can see why. It wasn't a success. It was well regarded, but like most Oscar movies, nobody went to see it.
Well, I mean, at 2 hours and 20 minutes, you're like, oh, do I really want to sit in a theater for 2 hours and 20 minutes watching this? Although you would have if you wanted to see it as a stage play.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it was a very successful stage play, which is probably why they did the feature in the first place. But it still watches like one in many regards. At least they try to give you some decent sets. Like the opening is the only scene outside, really, as Michael Caine's arriving. And you've got Sir Lord Laurence Olivier sitting out there. So we got some aerial shots and crane shots, and that was pretty cool. But yes, this stars Laurence Olivier as Andrew Wyke, the eccentric author of murder mysteries, and he's been in lots of great stuff. I mean, there's a reason why you know the name, because he is a legend, Marathon Man. But we talked about him in probably not one of his best roles in episode 48,
Clash of the Titans.
That's the one. It's the only one. And then there's Michael Caine as Milo Tyndall, and I'm not going to get into his accolades just yet. We'll save that for part two. But it's a long list, so we'll save it.
Yes.
But there's also credit given to Alec Cawthorn as Inspector Doppler, who is also Michael Caine. John Matthews as Detective Sergeant Tarrant. And that is also Michael Caine talking to himself. Eve Channing as Marguerite Wyke. And I do believe she gets credit because there's a photo of her.
Yep.
Actually, a painting, isn't it?
A painting, yes, a painting. Yeah. So it's a painting of somebody. And Teddy Martin as Police Constable Higgins. Probably also Michael Caine.
Yeah.
With the score of this movie by John Addison, because I have room to say other people, and a lot of the music used in the characters listening to was old Cole Porter songs.
Yeah, like, I don't know, when they talk about like an Oscar movie and nobody wants to go see it, I'm like, of a lot of Oscar movies, this one was more enjoyable than a lot of them. I mean, a lot happens, but it's not as much of a downer as some other movies.
Well, it is at the end.
Yeah, but, I'm like, really? Yeah.
Like, very much
well,
so.
Well, overall, but
yeah, throughout the storytelling, and I mean, the whole bit with him getting dressed up as a clown was part of it was his excitement, and he chose the outfit of his own humiliation. And then there's the moments of levity with him trying to climb up the ladder and those big shoes and falling off the ladder. Like, it's felt very slapsticky. And it changes the tone of the film, so when it goes dark again, you actually are caught quite off guard.
Yeah, this is the basic plot here, to try to strip down the story. You've got Milo Tyndall going to Andrew Wyke. He's been invited by Wyke to the mansion to talk about his wife. Wyke knows that this man is seeing his wife. They're estranged. She's moved out. And he's planned this elaborate game. But he's trying not to start adversarially. The verbal barbs are quite good back and forth, where it's a little bit threatening and then it's a little jovial. But the essential plot here is he doesn't think this guy, this hairdresser, can afford his wife. And he has this elaborate plan that if we stage a robbery of the jewels that I bought for her to wear, even though they're in my name, I'll get the insurance. And you'll have enough money to keep her in a lifestyle that she is accustomed to.
The key in actually both films, in order to kind of gain his trust, he does mention, he's like, look, if she leaves me, I want her to be gone forever. I do not want her to come back. So this is why you have to have the money.
Yeah, and there's this subtext throughout the whole film is like, he's saying one thing, but he means something mm-hmm. completely different. Because the whole film, I mean, spoiler, is how he's angry that this upstart has taken something that belongs to him. Right? Yeah. And that's the right of privilege that is the undercurrent of both films.
But I would say in the original, Milo is smarter. Like, it seems like in some instances, he's in on what's happening. So he's able to kind of do what he needs to do to get one over.
Well, he's smart enough to maintain a dialogue with Olivier's character, but he also was taken in by the charm of White quite a bit because he is charming. He's entertaining to watch, even though he's quite clearly mad.
As a Hatter.
And that's, I think, the biggest difference that Kane brings to his interpretation of the role is he doesn't have that same madness because Olivier talks in voices. He talks to himself. He changes accents. Like, he was hugely entertaining to watch, but, and it just like reinforced how crazy this man really is.
Like when they're trying to dishevel the house and he's like, come on, rip something. Like, he's trying to get out his own anger, but like trying to disguise it as having Michael Caine make it look like a robbery.
Oh, Michael Caine's onto him too. And he will try to upset some things that White actually cares about. Cause he cares about his future wife here and, destroying all her possessions and stuff. It's like, oh, I see. He's got some deep seated anger here. And this is a cathartic moment for him, but I'm not going to let him have it. And that's where you could see he's a little more devious himself. And it's like, he's not falling for everything that's going on here. And he does play up his naivete for the first part of it. You don't know he's got those kind of levels in and of himself.
Yeah.
In the second half, which gets really dark.
Yeah. The one other thing too is Kane's Milo is moderately successful. I mean, he's an upstart, right? He's putting on airs. He's got the bespoke suit and the fancy car, but he's moderately successful. He owns two shops and he's doing okay for himself. One shop's kind of breaking even and the other one's on its way. So he's not as low class as Jude Law's version of Milo is because he's a struggling actor, part-time hairdresser, drives a shitty little car. So there's a difference in those two interpretations of Milo as well that I found really interesting.
Yeah. It's because the whole point with Olivier, even if he's moderately successful, for Olivier, he's this half Italian upstart from an immigrant family. So according to Olivier, obviously he's stupid, which Michael Caine just takes complete advantage of. Like, he kind of knows that because of my class, this guy just thinks I'm an idiot.
Yeah. I mean, one of the first things that Olivier's wife does is poke fun at Milo's suit.
Mm-hmm.
It's like one of the very first things he does. And I like the way that they sort of focused on how Milo has everything monogrammed with his MT.
Mm-hmm.
And I love the way that it plays out throughout the rest of the film. And it actually is part of the payoff.
Yes.
And these are kind of details you figure a fairly smart mystery writer would catch, but I like how they play on that. Like, mysteries novels were fairly big in the 70s, and you had lots of stuff, and these movies play with those tropes that were established with Miss Marple and all those things, Sherlock Holmes and whatnot, and how the police are portrayed in these type of novels, usually completely inept without the help of this outside detective. So even in those novels, the police are looked down upon, and this is something that Michael Caine takes advantage of.
Very well, too. That was actually some of my favorite dialogue where he goes into that. It's like, well, not all cops are as incompetent as you make them out to be in your books. And we do the job and we know how to do our job. And I really enjoyed that.
Yes. Like, and he's also, what was great is him as a cop, he starts off actually kind of jovial. He's like, I just have a few questions. Like, he charms his own way in a way where he's like, I know you don't think much of me because I'm just a copper. And it makes it so much more satisfying when he starts putting the screws to him. Because he's like, yeah, you thought I was stupid, but I'm not.
Yeah, and that's initially when that cop, doppelganger, is questioning Wyke about the murder of this missing hairdresser. Spoilers. We weren't you. What were you expecting? It's a mystery. So he's coming in asking some questions, but in Wyke's mind, like, this was all a game and he didn't do anything wrong. But with the cop coming in, he does cover it up and lies about it initially, but there's a bullet hole in the wall. There's a clearly a picture missing on the wall where another bullet had landed, because the smaller picture was replacing it. And you can see the outline of the larger picture that was shot, which was of his wife.
Yep.
And there's the car outside, which, who monograms their car?
Right?
And then, of course, his clothes were found, also monogrammed. At least that made sense, but who monograms their car?
Maybe it was a 70s thing, but I mean, honestly, if it gets stolen, like, that's a whole new, if it's really embedded, it's kind of hard to get rid of. You might see some bumpiness. It might help.
Part of it, too, is Milo has a lot of disdain. Or he loves his father, but he also has a lot of disdain for him. And there's these points where he slips into gutter language. Like, he says things that he is trying not to say, because he's trying to be this person he's presenting himself as, and he's trying not to speak like he would have as a child. And I think the monogram is kind of represents that for him as well, as it shows that I have enough money to do this. I am a better person than I was when I was growing up. So it's in his slightly broken mind, he sees that as proof of his success.
Yeah.
And you do still see that nowadays, where people who think having their initials on everything shows how successful they are, when it just shows that you're an asshole.
Well, it's the same thing when people are like, oh, look, this is a Gucci thing, or this is a Calvin Klein. Like, we'll buy named stuff and just be free advertising, not realizing that they're just free advertising.
Yeah, nobody gives a shit you have a $3,000 purse. No, we all just think you're an idiot. Yeah, we're all laughing at you, by the way.
You bought $3,000 for a container.
Yeah.
A container.
Fooling their money.
Yeah, that you're going to put on a bathroom floor.
Yeah.
Just saying.
Purses come in contact with a lot of shit. They are gross as hell.
Yeah.
Just letting you know, man. Oh, ugh.
That's why I don't carry one.
Well, you also have better pockets. I want cargo pants to come back in a big way, because that would help me out greatly.
You know what? My wife has never stopped wearing them for that very reason. She's like, fuck fashion. I'm just going to wear stuff that's practical.
Absolutely.
I'm wearing cargo shorts right now. Pockets are empty, but when I go out, I can stick the world in them.
Nice. Michael Caine has sort of a disdain for his father, which is, I find, kind of interesting too, because he tells us that his father repairs watches. And the whole time I'm sitting there going, wow, like, somebody who deals with watches, what an incredible skill. I like have so much respect for his father, but I guess it's just because I'm looking at it with 2021 eyes.
Yes, I agree with you. I'm like, how is that lowly in any way? I mean, he's a craftsman.
Yeah.
But I guess it's because he never made any money doing it for some reason. But
it's a time-honored profession. At least it was.
Yeah.
Before everybody went to digital and Apple Watches, now you got to take them to the Apple store.
But now there's like guys who will pay, again, like $10,000 for a really big fancy watch.
Oh, and they're always usually huge and gaudy to me. I don't get it. And again, that's a status thing. I don't even wear a watch anymore. Like, I have a phone that tells me the time. I'm so happy to not have that thing on my wrist anymore.
Exactly.
I always had weird tan lines.
It's interesting, too, where it's like the hairdresser thing. I think as well, in this time, being a male hairdresser is like kind of a status symbol. Like, they were playboys at this point in time, and how interesting that that's changed over the years.
Let's get back to the plot here. We've got a supposedly murdered Tyndall and Doppler asking questions and really starting to make Wyke scared, because he's, for every explanation, the cop's got more and more questions, and it's looking more and more shady that this guy did commit a murder, and he's admitting to it, really. He was like, it was just a game. We staged a robbery, played robbery, and I pretended to shoot him. I shot two real bullets into the wall and a fake one at him. And that's when things get really hairy. So you put a gun to this guy's head and thought that was okay.
Right?
Yeah, no, I love that. And I love the way there's another scene outside where he brings him to the turned soil. And I love the way that that comes back later too.
Like,
that's the beauty of this original movie, is almost everything comes back at some point in the movie. And then the stuff you expect to come back doesn't, like the Allan Poe award that sits on the mantle. Like, you're expecting that to play out somewhere, and it's just this thing that's on his mantle.
The red herring.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, once he reveals himself and then the second game begins, that's when I'm like, oh man, this has gotten really dark, because he's basically trying to make Wyke feel like Wyke made Milo feel, begging for his life. Just humiliation on the highest level. And the police thing was just the start. So he claims he had killed the night before Wyke's mistress. And things get really bad. He's like, I've arranged for the cops to be here at a certain time. And you have, 20 minutes to find the murder weapon and all these other pieces of evidence. And thus the new game begins, as Wyke is frantically looking around his house for the murder weapon. And we get hints and in riddles and things like that along the way. And with all these objects, like, there's this one doll that kind of had this braid. And I kept thinking, was that what he used to strangle her? You know? And even now, like, I'm wondering, the way that movie ends and the cops do show up, was this a game? Did he really do it? Because he says he didn't afterwards, after the humiliation is complete, and then the cops show up anyway. Did he? I don't know. Because he was so unhinged during that and so scary.
Yeah, and that's what I love about the original, is there is that all those questions at the end, right?
Yeah.
The questions of, is Milo actually dead? Is Taya really dead? What happens to Wyke? Like, there's so many questions at the end. And that's what I loved about the ending, is you have questions. It's so ambiguous.
Like, why are the cops coming? I mean, sure, he did go to the cops after this whole game happened. And maybe they were just coming to question him about this, because that is the highly illegal torture of a human being.
It really is.
I mean, that's a horrible thing that you should be doing jail time for. So maybe they did take it seriously. That's the great thing about this movie, is it's all there. It's all explained. But is it right? Because so much is explained and then it's not the real thing. You know, it's always coming back around, like, okay, we're going to steal the jewels, but that was just to set up a murder that wasn't a real murder, which sets up this investigation, which wasn't an investigation, that turns into, oh, I murdered your mistress, which may have not been. And he's like, I'm a charming Italian. People do what I want when I sleep with them.
Right.
And they did kind of play into that a little bit in the remake, but they didn't travel that road. There was no murder of a mistress, even though the mistress is mentioned.
Yes.
Yes.
They take a very different approach to that third act, and parts of it worked really well for me, and then other parts really didn't.
Well, it's kind of funny. You mentioned, like, what is and what isn't. Going back to the original, it's what's great about Laurence Olivier's characters, as you talk about, like, he's unhinged. So part of the questions at that ending is, like, is he just kind of losing his mind at the end? Like, I mean, all you could do is just, like, play sirens outside the house, and he'd probably lose it.
That's the thing, is I think he went from being right on the edge of being uncontrollably mad to being forced over that edge. And that's, I think that's sort of where you see him at the end, with the automatons all around him, and him sort of, he's finally completely broken with reality at this point. That's the way I felt anyhow. It's still subject to interpretation, though. And that's what I love about it. No ambiguity at the end of the remake. None.
No.
All right. Well, let's take a break here, and we'll run the trailer for Sleuth from 2007.
Andrew Wyke.
That's right.
I'm Milo Tyndall.
Thanks for agreeing to see me.
What do you do, by the way?
I'm an actor.
Why have I never heard of you?
You will, before long.
That sounds threatening.
Does it?
Doesn't it?
What sort of parts do you play?
Killers, mostly.
But you're so charming.
Yes, I know. Anyway, what about this divorce? She's never coming back to you, so why not just give her the divorce?
My wife spends money like water. She's born to luxury. What are you? Out of work actor? You're out of your depth, old boy. But I have a solution. And you can keep Maggie in the manner to which she's become accustomed.
And you agree to the divorce. So what do I do?
You break in. Place the ladder against the wall.
Okay. climb up the ladder.
This is a joke.
God, this is
also a trap.
Ah! Die!
You think I'm a fool?
Well, are you?
Smash it!
Fantastic.
I want you to steal the jewels.
You're looking for the safe. It's up here somewhere.
£800,000 tax-free.
And this is where I
attack you.
How?
Get out my gun. The real game has just begun.
Is that a fact?
I bet you didn't expect me to be so intelligent, so quick-witted, did you?
Oh, I didn't. I've broken into your house because I know you have jewels.
Aren't you the wicked one?
That was a trailer from Sleuth 2007 with a screenplay by another legend, Harold Pinter. And he wrote The Handmaid's Tale in 99. He wrote the Modesty Blaze movie in 66. And he was an actor in Mansfield Park. He's been around the block a few times, and it was because of Pinter being involved in this movie that Michael Caine even considered doing it again. This time, Michael Caine returns as Andrew Wyke, switching roles with Laurence Olivier, and now Sir Michael Caine. And we've talked about Michael Caine a whole bunch of times. First time was in episode 13, Pre-Sam.
Italian Job?
Nope.
Oh, God. Oh, The Hand. One with The Hand.
Earlier than that.
Oh, good God. Then I'm lost. That's a very long time, and my brain didn't keep hold of it.
But good memory, though.
Yeah, it was Dirty Rotten Scoundrels.
That's right, yeah. Scoundrels. 21 was The Hand, and 91 was The Italian Job. This movie also stars Jude Law as Milo, and we've never talked about him before, but he was in Sherlock Holmes, those movies, more recently in Captain Marvel, and I kind of forgot he was in Existenz.
Yeah.
Harold Pinter was also the man on the TV with Kenneth Branagh, who's the other man on the TV. They're literally credited that way. This was directed by Kenneth Branagh, who we talked about in episode 135.
I missed 135.
The Road to El Dorado.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, the animated ones always throw me.
Yep. And episode 181.
Directed Murder and starred in Murder on the Orient Express.
That is
two connections, right. But two different versions.
Two different versions. I thought that was.
Yeah, I didn't look at his acting credit.
So you were going to say something about Jude Law there?
Yeah, because this is the second time that he has played a role that Michael Caine had played in the past, because he also plays Alfie.
That's right.
So I think it's interesting that he's done roles that Michael Caine's done twice, and he's playing against Michael Caine in this one. I love the synchronicity of that.
I was looking at Michael Caine's when I was going through this, and I'm like, oh man, that list is going to get long.
Yeah.
Because there's still several remakes we have yet to talk about.
Yeah, couple I'm looking forward to. Like Alfie, I'm looking forward to. Get Carter, maybe.
Get Carter, I think I could be okay with. Alfie is...
Yeah, I'm more on Trisha's side on this one. But we'll get there. We'll get there eventually. I was looking at other things like what to do next week. And they're like, oh, that could be good. And then I'm like, oh, Michael Caine's in it. No, we got to give him a breather. Okay, so we get into this one, and the biggest difference right away is, well, one, the way it's shot, reopening up with a lot of security footage until those cameras get turned off by Wyke, which we know it means bad shit's going to go down. But also the sterile nature of the house, where the original mansion is just full of stuff, these laughing mannequins that are remote controlled, and all these tchotchkes from traveling around the world, and awards and games and hidden rooms. Although they did maintain the hidden rooms.
Well, I love how they use technology to replace the automatons. Right, because all the gadgets in the house, like the security cameras and the little remote control, I love how they modernized it by doing that.
The ladder from the roof,
yes,
mm-hmm. All controlled by this little Apple remote that was meant for like an iPod or something. But it's not like we didn't know what it did, but it did everything. It's like Doctor Who's sonic screwdriver. It did everything. Like, how were you not accidentally activating everything in the house?
Right. You know what would have been better is like, you know, those remotes where you speak into the end and be like, play Netflix, something like that. If you had to say it into the remote, that would make more sense.
I guess if it was high tech enough and it just knew what room it was in to control things, but,
but you'd have several things in one room. How the hell does it know?
Yeah. This tiny little remote and you got ladders and lights and secret doors and it just everything had a remote. The fish tank in front of the safe, and that wasn't really a fish tank. And oh my God. I actually like the dartboard in the original where it was just like, boop, you get a.
I was about to say, I did enjoy that a lot more because, like, Milo Tyndall finds it.
Yeah.
Like, he asked, you find the safe. But in the second one, like, I don't know, Milo isn't smart enough to even question.
Well, the thing is, like, it's a little bit of a test on Michael Caine's part. How much have you learned about me already kind of thing? And go find the safe. I'm going to let you find the safe. And putting it behind a painting is just pedestrian. That's not up Wyke's alley. And similar with this version, but there's nothing to tell you. Other than I would have been like, well, give me the fucking remote. It's the only way I'm going to find it. It's going to be behind something stupid.
It'd be like, and then he wanders around the house, like trying to find a car in the parking lot. Boop, 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 boop.
Yeah. Just activating all sorts of stupid shit. But yeah, no, it made sense in the first one that it would be just this game because everything's a game to this dude.
And that's the only game in the room. And I did really enjoy that. But they almost entirely do away with that whole aspect of the original movie is the fact that Wyke's kind of obsessed with games and puzzles. And that's part of why I only kind of like the remake rather than potentially loving it, because they got rid of that aspect that was so important to Wyke's character.
And you know what? It would have really worked better in that film as well, because Wyke likes to play games with people. He likes to figure them out. Like, he makes characters. So to have him play a game with Milo would be more interesting, and why he would be somewhat enamored or intrigued by Milo if Milo was able to play the games.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I mean, he's working on such a high level as far as, like, in the original, he's got the hedge maze right away and secret doors there, and to work his way through this stuff. And as he gets better and better at playing these games, and it's all about just these adults playing in a lot of regards, where in the remake, Michael Caine's kind of looking for something that's missing, and they play on an aspect from the original that's there and dial it up to 11 in the remake. Now, one of the lines out of the many that are tossed around in the original is an accusation that Wyke is impotent. And this movie gives you a reason why.
Yeah.
Is that the wife was for a show. That's not where his proclivities are. He's not really, I don't think he's even turned on by men or women specifically. It's the mind that he's attracted to and the challenge that that gives him. And once he's realized that Milo can keep up with him, that's where this movie goes in a very different direction. Mm-hmm. Initially, it travels much the same path of steal the jewels, fake the murder, and then an inspector shows up. But once that reveal happens, it's no longer a go find the evidence to another murder that may or may not have happened. This has gone in a different direction where, and it's got to be ad-libbed. It can't be planned, but it's one of those things where maybe Milo knew more about Caine than he was letting on and was leading him on into thinking that, okay, yeah, I'll be your boy toy. I'll move in and become this trophy, this thing that you admire, and let you pay me for a lavish life, and I will give up this wife. And that's where things get, like, really uncomfortable. I kind of didn't mind it in the original, where it was this game between these two guys and it was a revenge, essentially, to turn it over. And once you start playing with a man or a woman's sexuality and leading them on, I'm like, oh, this is like getting unnecessarily cruel. But it ends in the same place. You know, it ends with Wyke being fed up and murdering the fucker. But you don't wind up liking Milo as much because of it.
Exactly. He becomes sort of likable, like from being a likable kind of rake who's kind of leaned into the game and is having a lot of actually having fun with it.
Yeah.
Really mean spirited, and it is revenge. Because he's gone from playing a game to really targeting Wyke's insecurities and loneliness. Well,
and they do kind of infer or make it seem as this, like, he's a con artist. He's done this countless times. Like, he just kind of seduces wealthy women and maybe robs their husbands or does other stuff. Like, he's not kind of what he seems at certain points.
There was a key piece of dialogue at the beginning of the film that Wyke just completely misses, because he constantly thinks this version of Milo is a hairdresser, which is a nice callback to the original, where in fact he was an actor struggling and taking other jobs like a chauffeur. But he was an actor, and I don't actually remember it being in the movie, but it was in the trailer where he said, well, what's your specialty? Murderers.
Oh, yeah. He does say in the movie where it's like murderers, pervs.
Yeah.
Like, he plays bad guys. Oh, but the other thing I need to talk about in this movie, Milo, for being a hairdresser, worst hair. Like, it's just terrible.
Yeah, neither Milo is a very good hairdresser if their hair looks like that.
No, Michael Caine's Milo, he was in fashion. 2007 Milo, I don't know what was going on there. Bad wig, maybe.
Yeah, if he had pulled off that hair too.
Yeah.
With his disguise, then it would have made it sound like the whole thing right from the beginning was a scam. And I would have leaned more into that idea that the whole thing was meant to be a scam to find out where the jewels were and then to get them later. He probably didn't plan on the whole humiliation part, but this movie's well written too. And it takes some brave strides as to get to that end moment. But overall, like, for me, I enjoyed the ride of the first one more.
Oh, agreed. Totally agreed. I like the remake, just like more than either of you might have. But yeah, it's still not as strong a film as the original, not by any stretch.
Yeah, it stomps on some ideas that could have been really good to look at. Because there's at one point where he's just talking to Milo, and Wyke is like, I'll payroll anything you want to do, any sort of project. And then it just goes on to, oh, but then I'll take you places and stuff. What would have been great is to have that slow build where he's trying to seduce Milo and be like, look, if you come onto my side, you're a struggling actor. Perhaps we could put together, you could be in one of the movies where one of my novels is based on. I could make that part of the contract. Like, that could be part of like Wyke's somewhat seduction of Milo.
That would have been a lot more interesting, certainly. Like, so there was definitely a lot of missed opportunities in the remake. I appreciate the fact that they tried so hard to bring it into the 21st century and make it different. Like, again, it does everything we ask of a remake. Is it takes the general precept and does something different with it. And it did. Again, did it work as well? No. But no. At least they tried.
Mm-hmm. It is basically taking everything from the stage play and reinterpreting it. Because, like I said before, Pinter had never seen the original film or the stage play. So he had no preconceptions of what this should look like and what should feel like. And he was taking threads that were in the original play or screenplay even and building on some of those threads. Now, I mean, to shave it down as much as they did, it loses a lot of its luster. And I feel like it's a bit of a harder ride, mainly because you don't have those points of levity and joy in this movie. It is just claustrophobic, and that helps you build the tension throughout the film. And maybe it's better that it's shorter, because eventually you're just going to exhaust the audience.
Yeah. It loses all the subtlety that the original has. And that's, I think, part of it too, is there's lots of subtlety to the performance because it's so dialogue driven.
And it seems to lose a lot of in the original, it's like the playfulness and the game playing. There was a lot of back and forth, but it's sort of in the remake, because it gets rid of a lot of the dancing around and the game playing. It's really just like one person's in the driver's seat and then the other person's in the driver's seat. That's kind of it.
You lose that sense of who they are. Like, that's what, I mean, I'm normally cringe when a movie's over 2 hours, but with this movie, it was kind of important because it gives you a sense of who these men are. Like, you get a real sense of the people that they are and how they change throughout the movie through their interactions with each other. And that is all lost in the remake. And I think that's why the third act doesn't work, is because you don't get that sense of how they've connected, even though they're very different and they initially meet over conflict. They are genuinely attracted to each other's personalities, and if it were different circumstances, they would have been friends. But you don't get that in this remake. Like, it's just antagonistic all the way through.
Yeah, I'm going to go on a limb here and say this wasn't because of the talent involved. I mean, Michael Caine was in the original, so he clearly knew how to do this type of material, even though he was in the opposite role in this one. And I'd say Jude Law's just as capable of delivering that dialogue. And it's a shame to say that about Harold Pinter, but I don't think the script was quite up to snuff, because I think the directing itself was really good. Like, the actors did a good job. And there were times where I'm like, I'm really, really digging some of the artistic styles that are chosen by the director and how to shoot this. So it is an interesting piece, and maybe given some time, it might find some accolades. But right now, not so much. It's interesting they even went back to the well to do this, because it wasn't successful the first time. It made a little money, but the original film was a $3.5 million budget, which probably went to the set tech and talent, because there's not a whole lot of people to pay outside of the crew. So went on to gross into the U.S. a little over $4 million, so it did cross into the profit margin just barely, but imagine it didn't. The marketing wasn't really covered in that. And then maybe it's because of the rentals afterwards. It sounds like, from my research, it did better than theatrical. It did a little over 5 million, nearly 6 with rentals. Mm. Which,
well, and the Academy Awards didn't hurt either.
Yeah, and I think the acclaim that came with the film is probably why they were looking at it and maybe finding that audience now. I don't actually know what the budget of the remake was. I could not find it. But it had an opening weekend of only $50,000. It's grossed in the U.S. $342,000. And worldwide gross, so made most of its money abroad, was just under $5 million. I don't know what the budget was, but paying two people... you probably could have made this fairly cheap and on a similar budget. Although there was a lot of things in this movie, and probably in the other one too, with borrowed artwork and things like that, that were real. Mm. Like that wire man that was in his house in the remake. That was a real public sculpture in England.
Well, and you say like hundreds of thousands of dollars. I guarantee that both Jude Law and Michael Caine's fees were larger than that.
Yeah. Like I said, I don't know what the budget was, but I'm going to say it was in the millions, not the hundred thousands. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. But I think the challenge with both these films is they're both very, very British. And I don't know how many American audiences would want to see them. As much as I enjoyed them, there's definitely that UK-British sensibility to both films.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. Being that it's more about the British class system, which is I'd say you can still relate to it as a North American, but it is definitely more to British sensibility.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, sure. I mean, it is relatable, but it's the American interest in something like this, because it is a slower paced, two people dialogue driven film. Like, there's not a lot of.
It's a very intellectually driven film, which given how North Americans have been trained into summer blockbusters that turn your brain off, I can see why it didn't catch on here.
Yeah. Unless they blowed up real good.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to watch it.
That's
at least the original one actually had an explosion.
Yeah, right? It did.
Yeah. He just happens to have explosives in his house. He's like, I did some research for a book. Dude, but you still have explosives in your house.
Yes. One thing I want to mention too is Branagh loves to do these sort of vanity projects. He's one of those directors who's like, I just want to do this. I don't care if it makes money or not. I just want to do it. I mean, that's pretty much almost everything he's ever directed. It's just stuff that he wants to do. I mean, kudos to him as a director for doing stuff like that.
Yeah, and he's very drawn to classics and stage and intellectual properties, thus going back to do Murder on the Orient Express, which proved to be quite a success for him, even though I don't think it was quite as good as the original film. But, you know, he's done lots of Shakespeare, lots of stage material, so I can certainly see why he was drawn to this classic British stage play.
Which is why I'm eminently surprised that he didn't notice how the speed of this script totally like took us away from the character development that is very key to having the entire final act work.
Yeah, and maybe it's just because movies that long, I think he maybe is assuming the audiences just didn't have the same attention span. And I find that the original is overly long as well. But it's always interesting.
He'd done a bunch of movies that are well over 2 hours.
Yeah.
So he's not afraid to do that.
That's true. His Murder in the Orient Express. But, you know, he thinks a little more mainstream, I think, because even his Murder in the Orient Express, and go back to listen to that episode, but he does do kind of more mainstream Hollywood ideas within them. And I think here's Branagh, as much respect as I have for him, and I think he considers himself more intellectual than he actually is, if that makes any sense.
Yes.
Like his character in Harry Potter.
Like a lot of people. He's not just Kenneth Branagh. A lot of humans do. It's generally accepted. Everybody thinks they're smarter than they are. I know I'm not.
But yeah, I think he thinks he's a little more clever than he actually is, whereas he'll take something that is clever and then it turns it. He tries to make it a more modern, and by modernizing it, it kind of makes it more stupid.
Well, what's really interesting about this one, when you talk about the direction is good and the acting is good, you are right. Because there's certain moments where I'm watching Jude Law and he is flirting with Michael Caine. Like he's full on flirting, like doing the seductive looks. And with Michael Caine, there's moments where he's capturing just this longing for Jude Law and like that companionship. So it's getting captured, but it's just getting stomped on by the speed.
Yeah,
exactly.
I think you're right. I think it all comes down to the pacing of the film. And it's just like, okay, we're in a rush to hit all these points. And you know, at 88 minutes, you had some room, even if it was just 15 minutes, if you wanted to keep it under 2 hours. What I think really helped the pace of this film, the original film, considered one of the best of the year, sits in the, you know, that book, the 1,000 Movies You Must See Before You Die. It's in there.
Nice. As it should be.
Yeah. IMDb gives it an 8 out of 10. Pretty high praise. The Rotten Tomatoes was pretty impressive as well. Anybody want to take a guess?
Oh, 83.
Critic score, I'm going to say 93.
And Sam was the closest without going over. The critic score was 96%, making it one of the highest rated movies we've ever talked about.
Well, when you look at the genius of those performances and the dialogue, it deserves it. It really does.
Mm-hmm. And anybody want to take a stab at what audiences think about this movie?
I'll go 83 again.
I think they're a little bit lower than critics, but not much. I'm going to go with 87.
Once again, Sam's closest without going over 90%, which gives me faith sometimes in the Rotten Tomatoes, where I think it's a little out to lunch, but very highly regarded by those who have seen it. And I could see how this might be a difficult watch for some, but those who were brave enough to watch it really saw what it was going for and really a great piece of work.
Absolutely.
Now I have to thank Trish for recommending it because I have never seen either one of them and may never have. So,
well, you know, I was thinking and I was like, I really wanted to see it as well. I don't think I'd seen it. I'd heard of it. And then I was like, you know what? This might be like, it's a little bit out of any other genres we've done in a while. So I thought, oh, a nice treat for everyone.
Yeah. And it's one of those movies that's always been on in my consciousness as a movie that I should see, but I've never actually gotten around to it. So yeah, I'm going to echo Jay and say thank you, Trish, because I am so glad I saw both of these.
In the back of my mind, when she said Sleuth, I'm like, I honestly thought I was going to get a more serious version of Clue.
No.
I did not. I had no idea what this movie was about, clearly. So it was quite a surprise for me in the end.
I was going to say, this is one that I always mix up with the one that Michael Caine did with Christopher Reeve, because it's another sort of two-person...
Death Trap.
Yes, which is another great film.
It's very good.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I don't think I've seen that one either.
You should. It's unremakeable.
Okay,
it's
get off my back. Good Lord. Maybe we'll just do an episode on it.
No. We can't do it. You have to do this in your own time is what I'm saying, because okay. I don't want to try and do it.
Okay.
No, I am with Trish on that.
Well, that's where I was like, I don't want to remake this one, because that's going to be fucking hard. And clearly, yeah, Kenneth Branagh, Kenneth Branagh discovered how hard it is. Let's do the Rotten Tomatoes for the remake from 2007. What do you think the critics thought of this one?
Ooh. I didn't go first, Trish? A lot of them didn't like it. Yeah, please.
Okay. I'm going to go with 62%.
Okay.
I'm probably being generous.
I'm going to do 53.
Both being generous. The original film, one of the best of the year. Remake, one of the worst of the year. Critics gave it 36%.
Whoa. Okay.
I think that's a little unfair, to be honest.
Yes and no. I mean, I think maybe that number's overly harsh, yes. Maybe this movie is underappreciated because it is still very clever, but I think maybe Sam and Trish's number is a little more realistic as far as my interpretation goes, which may clue us into where audiences thought of this movie. Ladies, gentlemen, what do you think?
Sam, you go first.
I'm going to stick with my 62.
Okay. 50. I'm just going to go 50.
Trish, 1% off. Without going over, 51% of the audiences on Rotten Tomatoes like this movie. So
I finally win one.
Today, anyway, yeah. You know, critics thinking maybe a little overly harsh, but could be timing. I mean, we know what the failing of this movie is. It wasn't the directing. It wasn't as much as claustrophobic as the set was. It was still a well-designed set. Certainly wasn't the actors' performances. They were very good at it. But the overall pacing of the movie and that third act, it goes into places that are uncomfortable to watch. And it might be the point of the film.
I think part of the other thing, too, is I would expect that most critics have seen the original, and comparison is always unfair for movies like this sometimes.
Oh.
Always sometimes.
Yeah.
I think if you had seen this movie without being aware of the original or having seen the original, I think that you would have gotten more into that 50%, 60% mark in terms of your enjoyment of it. But comparing it to the original, I can see where critics would go with like under 40%, if that makes sense.
Yeah. The performance that Olivier was giving in that one, I mean, Jesus Christ, he's the Daniel Day-Lewis of his day. Like, he's so good, so amazing to watch, even at his age in that movie. And Michael Caine, still an up-and-comer in the 70s, was really showing his chops as well. And,
oh, so good.
You know, by the time the remake is, I think here's a man who is probably very hesitant to even entertained doing it and was attracted by the Harold Pinter script, but in the end it kind of let us down. So I don't know, going back to the well in your own movie sometimes doesn't pay off, I guess. Maybe he was hoping, I'm like, I didn't win the Oscar the first time, but maybe I'll win it the second time. Or not. But we don't think any less of you, Michael Caine.
No. The whole time in the first movie I just kept thinking to myself, I'm like, yeah, I like this version of Michael Caine. I think if he's very kind of flirty, I'd be like, yeah, I totally fall for his charms. I totally get it. I get it, cheating wife. I get it.
Heck, I get it with Jude Law too, man.
I sort of do, but there's a cruel underlying in some of it. That
he
would unnerve me.
Yeah. Oh, and I actually quite like the performance at the end, even though I didn't like the direction. Because you could tell that he was just placating Michael Caine, and I don't think Michael Caine's character was fully buying the performance either.
No, his final act at the end there,
By the end, he was very heartbroken that didn't work out. Well, it's not going to work out with a bullet in his head, but all right.
No.
Yeah, Jude Law's Milo, I mean, right from the get-go, there's an arrogance about him that Caine didn't bring to his version of Milo. There's a confidence to Caine's Milo, and there's certainly – you could get the sense of desire that he wants to be in the position that Wyke is in, But it's not arrogance. It's a confidence and it's a difference.
Yeah. He's just like, well, I'll just grow my businesses. Like, as I see you now is once my businesses grow, I'll be in your shoes in a few years.
Exactly.
Yeah. You kind of like think like that Michael Caine playing Milo, you know, that character was destined for success with the where his headspace was. Can't say the same about Jude Law's version of the character. I think his arrogance probably would have ended in turmoil, but it ended with a bullet in his head. So yes, it did.
Yeah.
But
yeah, and
unfortunately, that's how it ended for both.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But well, no, because that's what I was just about to say. There is there's nothing about the ending of the remake that's ambiguous. Milo is dead, right? Pure and simple. But I think that because Kane's Milo got shot in the body, there's a possibility. There's that minute possibility that he actually survived his experience with Wyke.
Yeah.
Right? I'm going to disagree a little bit. I think he was shot, and I think it was just a case of what they were comfortable showing in 72 and what they wanted their rating to be. I mean, clearly the sleuth 2007 was hitting more mature subjects and they were letting the F-bombs fly. Yeah. Yeah. And nobody says cunt like the British.
No.
Right?
Nobody.
It's true. But, well, no, I mean, they didn't shy away from the fact that Milo was shot. I mean, he had blood in his mouth and he had been shot, but he wasn't shot in the head. He was shot in the body, right? So there's that question of whether or not that was a fatal body shot.
And I figured, well, he was quote unquote hiding the evidence around the house. What makes you think he didn't load the gun with blanks?
Yeah, I kind of thought that too, and that could be a possibility. He didn't like fall over and die right away, but it was that slow death as the police roll up that last little laugh that he had that made me think, yeah, okay, he probably died. I mean, but with the police arriving right away, maybe they could have resuscitated him. Who knows?
Exactly, and that's what I liked about the ambiguity of it. But I mean, part of his projecting, because I did like his Milo so much.
Mm-hmm.
I wanted him to be the victor, right? And in some ways he was, but at a cost, right? Whether that's being permanently disabled from a bullet in the spine or being dead. But yeah, no, I think I wanted him to be okay. So maybe I projected that a little bit.
That's the beauty of this film is you get attached to these characters, whether it's Wyke or Milo or both. And I could say I liked them both in the original film. And I disliked them both because of the extremes both of them go to for their point. Mm-hmm. There's many aspects I quite enjoyed about Wyke in the original film and that childlike way of looking at the world and wanting to continue to play in that world. But the levels he's willing to go to make a point and the possessiveness of this man and the vanity of this man, which is flips right back over to the other guy. So it's a back and forth game and it's very interesting to watch.
And there's actually a weird point I had, and I don't know if this is just because I'm adding other layers onto it, probably is, where, Milo, if you go with Milo dies in that movie, part of it could be love. He's kind of like, well, if I die and you've murdered me, your wife is now free, and, well, who's going to have your money? Probably your wife.
And that's what makes that movie work, is there is that opportunity for interpretation at the end.
Yeah, in the second movie, it's not cop car arriving, it's his wife.
Yeah.
Because you can tell it's not a patrol car. And it sounded like Milo had lost her anyway, which makes you wonder what he was fighting for. And that maybe that's where the critic's going, what's the point of all this if he lost the girl anyway? And she's coming back for the money and she is everything that Wyke said she was. This gold digger. And if you're that possessive about her but don't actually want her, I don't know, what was the whole point of the whole thing?
No, it becomes a battle of wills between two men. Mm-hmm. Is Wyke humiliated Milo? And Milo,
it's clear why Milo is doing what he's doing. It's not lost on me.
It had nothing to do with the wife anymore at that point. I think it became part of Milo's ego, which is why I didn't feel anything when he got shot. It's like, well, I knew it was coming because it was in the original, but also I just didn't care. It actually turned, because Milo was the villain by the end.
Oh, yeah, yeah. That's just it. You never feel like Michael Caine isn't unjustified in his anger. And he does get cruel, but he's justified in what he's doing. And he even says, like, this isn't a fucking game to me. You enjoy this. I do not. But you're going to feel what I felt. And it feels like more villainy at the end. And maybe that's one of the things that the critics find unappealing about it. And I certainly would agree with that as well.
Yeah, and as do I. I didn't get that connection with the Milo character like I did in the original, which was disappointing. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Although I did find Kane's version of Wyke a little more likable. I found I enjoyed Olivier's more, if that makes sense, just because of how manic he was all the way through the film. But there's a steadfastness about Kane's version of Wyke. And there's that one bit where he messes with Milo a little bit with the ladder, where it's like where it won't come down. And I enjoyed that because it sort of showed that he was playing a little bit. I mean, he was misguided in his maliciousness, but he didn't actually intend Milo harm.
I was hoping that there'd be more of that playfulness because that's near the beginning of the movie. And then it just disappears forever.
Yeah, we just don't get enough of the things that made the original enjoyable. All right. Well, I think I spy something else, something where you can find a whole lot more Michael Caine in our back catalog. And we got a website where you can visit and find all of our archives. Sam, where can they find the archives?
Well, it's a mystery, but I've solved it for you. It's invasionoftheremake.wixsite.com/podcast.
That's right. And over there you can find all of our back catalog and links to all your favorite podcatchers and a few you might not even know about. So just pick one and you can listen to the nearly 300 episodes. We're almost there, guys. And actually, we're probably over 300 with the shorts and stuff. And it's a lot of episodes. It's a lot of stuff to digest and a lot of movies. And I'm sure there's lots of movies in there that you will enjoy us talking about. Also, you'll find a handy dandy little button that'll take you to our store, our Tee Public store, where you can find, of course, t-shirts, mugs, posters, PPE masks, totes, and so much more. So just click that button and it'll take you to the Tee Public store and everything. Every little dollar we make from the small cut that TE Public gives us goes back into the production of the show. And make sure you tell your friends and family where to find us. Of course, we've given you the site, so it's easy to do. So just spread the word to friend and foe and make sure you follow us on our social media at Invasion Remake on Twitter, Invasion the Remake on Facebook and Instagram, and invasiontheremake@gmail.com if you want to email us your suggestions, your corrections, and your comments, and of course, your fan challenges. And we're always looking to add to the list, and we dive into it periodically in no particular order. Mm-hmm. So if we liked your idea and we said we'll probably do it in a future episode, well, the future is the future until it becomes the present. Very deep of me. But just be patient. We'll get to it when we get to it. And those who have succeeded in getting a fan challenge through the tough criteria that we have, I'm going to share that criteria with you. We'll all share the criteria with you.
Yes.
Sam, what's the first one?
Must be no newer than 2001.
Correct. 2000. 20-year cutoff. Although there are times where I'm like, oh, it's a 2002. Maybe we'll do that one. You got to make a good sell. You got to make a good sell.
Yeah.
And Trish, what's number two?
Nothing too great. Like if it's like an award-winning movie, we don't want to remake something good. We can make it worse. We're good at that. But please don't make it something like that.
Yeah. Although fan challenges, some of our fans are malicious. they try to make it really hard on us.
Here's a movie like one starring that's terrible.
Yeah. If you got something with like that was terrible and nugget a good idea, that leaves us a lot of room and we love that. We can get really creative with that. But we've been throwing musicals. We've been throwing puppets.
Academy Award movies.
Yeah, there's times where we've been throwing some hard stuff.
Yep.
But we'll find an angle. We always do. And just make sure you tell us why you think it should be remade. Follow our criteria and tell us where to find it. Help source it for us so we can actually watch the thing that you want us to do. And maybe it will become a future episode. Always like to hear your suggestions, even if we don't do it. So the only way you know for sure is just to let your voice be heard. And you can do it on our Twitter or Facebook and Instagram. And, of course, our email if you don't want to do it. And what is it now on Twitter? 240 characters or something? I don't know.
Yeah.
It's not much. It's better than it was.
It's enough.
You can go, here's the movie. Here's where it's at. You should be able to get it in there.
Or just follow us and DM us.
Oh, that's easier. Yeah.
Yes.
That's much easier. Yeah.
And then you don't miss all the fun stuff we do on Twitter as well. We had a poll last week that we had a lot of fun with. I do try to keep some interactive stuff happening there.
Yeah. I actually did a small plug on the season finale of the Last Drive-In on Shudder.
I saw that.
You never know. I don't do the Twitter very often, but every now and again something will come up and I'm like, "Oh, I got to tweet about that." Usually that's Sam's department.
You don't tweet a lot?
I don't tweet it a lot. I don't tweet. Yeah, I'm on Slasher sometimes. Yeah, nice. That's a new horror app for horror people. So yeah, we don't have to hang out with the regs.
Exactly. I always try to log on, but it's always busy or something's wrong.
Yeah.
I guess it depends on your device.
Yeah.
It really depends on your device, because if I go on my phone, I have a lot of trouble. But if I use my tablet, which is newer, I don't have any trouble at all.
Oh, good to know.
Yeah. Update your iOS. Yeah. All right. Well, that was Sleuth. Thanks, Trish, for your birthday pick. That was a lot of fun and a lot of Michael Caine.
You know, sometimes you just got to scratch that Caine.
That's right.
That sounds like something you need a balm or a solve for.
Well,
there you go.
That ups his presence to 4 episodes and 5 movies.
Yep.
I mean, this counts as 2, Brian.
Yep.
Yeah. So he's getting there. He's getting there. There's still worse, though.
Yeah, but it's only one referenced episode, so we're good there.
Yeah, yeah. It was like last week when I didn't want to go through the Dick Miller stuff.
Oh, God, yeah.
Or God forbid, the Roger Corman. The amount of, the sheer volume of Roger Corman we've done.
I know.
I just think, go look at our list. It's like 25% of it or more.
Yep. Well, it's just, he's just got that wonderful nugget of a good idea. We could make it better.
Exactly. Exactly. All right. Well, that's it for this week. We're going to be back next week where we're going to remake something on the sly. Until then, I've been Jason.
I'm always Sam.
And I continue to be Trish.
And we are out of here.
Seven years to regret the play of silly games that go wrong.
Spare me the 7 of your dumb money. Didn't go wrong at all, but it bloody well right.
You think so, do you, sir? We real life policemen are not as stupid as we are sometimes portrayed by writers like yourself. We may not have our monocles or our orchid houses, our deer stalkers, or our shovel hats. But we are reasonably effective for all that, sir.
You seem to know a hell of a lot about detective stories, Inspector.
Yes, I have read quite a few in my time, sir. And in recent years, I have come to believe that the detective story is the normal recreation of noble minds, sir.
Oh, what the hell are you?
Detective, Inspector, Doppler, sir. It is spelt like Doppel, which, as I'm sure you know, means double in German. And for those whose minds run to these things, it is virtually an anagram of the word plotter. So, Inspector Plotter becomes Inspector Doppler. If you see what I mean.